Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and Grantham University. Now, here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today, we'll be joined by former Congressman Harold Ford Jr. and Bob Edgar, and National Education Association Executive Director John Wilson. Welcome to Inside Government.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So you've written a really interesting book, More Davids Than Goliaths, A Political Education. Tell me a little about the book.
Well, first of all, thanks again for having me on. The title of the book, I'll start there. It's really inspired by my father and some of the lessons, maybe one of the most important lessons he taught me about public service and politics. He said that all Goliaths are not bad, but all Davids are good. And which you have to remember, and if you ever get elected to office and while you're in office, if you serve, is that you have a responsibility, a huge responsibility to give voice and to always try to represent and advocate on behalf of those who don't have a seat at the table or sometimes have a hard time being heard. And the book is about how I grew up in politics and how that lesson and others that flow from it, how I learned it. My dad was my predecessor in the Congress. I served for 10 years. From 96 to 2006. My dad was my predecessor for 22 years. So I really grew up in and around politics. I have a family that is active and engaged back in Memphis and Tennessee, in local and state politics. So I learned it in many ways, and what I'd say, and some would say in an honest way, I learned at an early age that I would be a Democrat because my parents told me I'd be a Democrat. Then over a period of time and sort of my evolution in politics and throughout school, I realized why I wanted to be a Democrat and realized even at times that I was somewhat of a different Democrat than some of the traditional and conventional definitions apply. So the book walks through that, how I ran for Congress, how my dad actually ran for Congress the first time, and how I was introduced to it, doing TV commercials for him and walking the streets and knocking on doors and bumper stickering cars, and I ran for Congress the first time and some of the challenges associated with that and ultimately the triumph of winning. And the book ends with a look at the Senate race, a Senate race that I undertook in 2006 in Tennessee. Although the outcome was not what I wanted, it was a great learning experience, and I talk honestly about some of the things that I thought happened during that race that caused us to do well and some of the things at the end that were outside of my control that I think I ended up hurting us pretty badly.
Now, I noticed one of the things in the book you talk about is, in addition to family being involved in politics, you also talk about your faith and being in the church and how that influenced you as well. Can you tell us a little about that?
Sure. I grew up in church. It was another area of my life which I learned the old-fashioned way. I was forced to go to church on Sunday mornings as a kid and forced to go to Sunday school. The title of the book also draws some inspiration from my Sunday school teachers when I was much younger, when I was in my, before I was a teenager. Every Sunday morning, my brothers and I were forced to go to Sunday school. And we were even in the summertime forced to go to vacation Bible study. And I'll never forget a pastor, one of the pastors at a church in Memphis called Greater Mount Moriah Baptist Church, Reverend Payne, would often open up our Sunday vacation Bible study classes, which were every day in the summer for about 3 or 4 weeks, and say that there are more Davids and Goliaths and more answers and problems. And that would often go in one ear and out the other. I was just hopeful that the 2 hours of vacation Bible study would end quickly so I could get back to swimming and doing what other kids were doing during the summer. But as I got older, it stuck with me more and more. And my dad would often talk about it to me as I was running for office. And my church growing up experience, I mean, like most kids, I didn't appreciate it at all when I was a kid. I didn't want to be in church. I thought there were other things to be doing. I was playing and talking during church. But it was one of the most important things my parents did as we were kids, because it helped me understand much better over a long period of time just the difference between right and wrong. And my parents and grandparents and others tried to reinforce that. And I credit that in large part with, as growing up, I never did drugs, never tried drugs as a kid. I was afraid of it in many ways because I thought that the things my grandmother warned me about and the things that I learned in church, shouldn't say afraid, I was admonished in church not to do it, admonished by my parents and grandparents not to do it as well. So my faith remains an important part of who I am. Even now that I live in New York, my wife and I attend church regularly. In fact, we attend a church right in our neighborhood. We live right in the Flatiron and Union Square area, and we attend church right at 12th and 5th Avenue here in New York at First Presbyterian. So continues to be an important part of my life, and my faith, like many Americans, is something I lean on heavily.
And let's fast forward now to when you got into Congress. You refer to it in the book as a chapter of being in kindergarten or being a kindergarten congressman. Tell us a little about what life was like being in Congress at such a young age.
Well, that chapter, actually, the kindergarten congressman chapter, the next chapter flows into, but that chapter is about my actual first run for Congress, and the title of that chapter is inspired largely by the fact that when I ran the first time, I was still a law student at the University of Michigan. I was commuting between Ann Arbor, which really from the Detroit airport to Memphis each week as I was exploring the race, and I announced for the Congress about a month before I graduated. I graduated from law school, but I was essentially campaigning throughout the second semester of my third year. And when I formally announced, after doing a lot of exploratory work, meeting with key people in the district and attending various events in the district and meeting one-on-one with business leaders and religious leaders, I was awaiting invitations after I announced, you know, to speak before labor groups and business groups and neighborhood organizations and civil rights organizations, many of the constituencies that make up a Democratic primary base. And I didn't receive any invitations. As a matter of fact, the only group of people to invite me really were a group of people that one of my campaign managers, which was my former elementary school principal in Memphis, which she had organized. And she walked into the office, I remember like it was yesterday, and I write about it in the book. She walked into my office and said, "Baby," she called me baby, she said, "Baby, I've got you 35 graduation speeches." I quickly and immediately assumed that they were high school graduations, so I summoned some of the young people working for me. I didn't have much money in the campaign early on, so people were working for free. And I urged them to go out and gather all of the voter registration forms they could find, because I figured at a minimum I could urge these kids or encourage these kids to register to vote. I knew I couldn't politic during my graduation speech, but I thought me being there was obvious who I wanted them to support, and I thought I could urge them to register. Upon hearing me say this to my campaign workers, my elementary school principal said, "Baby, these aren't high school graduations." So, again, I assumed they were middle school, so I, again, asked the workers to go out and grab the voter registration forms. And she interrupted again and said, "Sweetie, these aren't middle school." I said, "Well, Miss Jackson," which is her name, I said, "what are they?" She said, "Baby, I got you 32 kindergarten graduation speeches." And that was the start of my campaign. I didn't want to, you know, speak at these kindergartens, but out of respect for Miss Jackson, who had worked hard to get them, the other three graduation speeches were elementary ones. And I went out, set out in the trail to give these graduation speeches, and it really was the thing that sparked the campaign. I share in the book how I was traveling from one kindergarten speech to another, graduation speech to another, about halfway during this circuit. I was about 17 or 18 in, and my dad was riding with me, and we were listening to the radio, and one of the radio shows, which routinely criticized me, the radio host, they were interrupted by a caller, and we were pulling into the driveway at this next school, who identified herself as a grandmother and said that she was not going to vote for me. She had made her mind up until that day before. And the radio host said, "Well, what happened the day before?" She said, "Well, I went to my granddaughter's kindergarten graduation, and he was there speaking." And she said, "As I listened to him speak, I decided, and I watched how he behaved and conducted himself, I decided I was going to vote for him." And it was those kindergarten speeches that really gave me a lift and rejuvenated the campaign, and in so many ways gave us our kind of momentum. And anyone that's run for office or anyone that has found themselves in business or academia and found momentum for something they're doing, change or improve, to know what I'm talking about when you feel a momentum shift. After that woman called in, I mean, I can't tell you the number of parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles who I was running to as I was out campaigning. Said, "I heard you spoke at my neighbor's daughter's graduation. I heard you spoke at my niece's graduation. I heard you spoke at my son's graduation." And I became known by the newspaper as the kindergarten congressman. They originally used that term in a negative and derogatory way, but the Lord works in mysterious ways. It became kind of a mantra for the campaign. So that chapter is really about how you never know when a set of circumstances or set of opportunities that seem unusual, unconventional, and frankly, in a lot of ways, counterproductive, how they can present themselves. And if you follow through, how positive things can come from that. So that was that chapter there. I talk about Congress, and the next two chapters I talk about the service in the Congress. But the kindergarten congressman is really the take on what my local newspaper dubbed me as in a negative way and in a condescending and patronizing way. But as I said, the good Lord has a way of turning positive, turning negative into positive.
And let's talk about a negative for just a minute. The Senate race. I mean, I remember when the ad came out. I got to tell you, I politics is a tough business. I mean, you know, people call it hardball for a reason. But that was really over the top, and it really sickened a lot of people. I mean, that can be amongst the worst that people do in politics to candidates, and it keeps a lot of people from wanting to run for office. Tell us how you felt about that personally.
Well, and to give people a little context, thank you, the kind words you have there. But in the 2006 Senate race in Tennessee, we were started off the race way, way down and fought our way into a competitive contest. And matter of fact, according to some polling, we're either in a dead heat or running just a few points ahead, but all within the margin of error. My opponent at the time, with the help of the Republican National Committee, launched an ad featuring a scantily dressed, if at all dressed, woman, a white woman, who made the point that she had met me at a party and that she wanted me to call her, and the insinuations and implications were fairly obvious. It was an effort in a lot of ways. Not in an interracial marriage. I was not married then, but my opponent was trying his hardest to project to a public in Tennessee that I was dating a white woman. I'm African American, and this ad helped them accomplish some of that. And it was an unfortunate thing to do. It was an ugly ad. The first time I saw it, though, I thought to myself how brilliant the ad was, because my opponent, who claimed he had nothing to do with it, but in fact, you know, worked with the RNC and traveled with their chief deputy in Tennessee the last several weeks, benefited from it largely because he knew if I criticized the ad that I would be injecting race into the campaign, which I had not done throughout, and which I thought had, number one, I don't like talking about race, and I didn't think it was a factor up until that point my race was not a factor in the Senate race up until the point in which they ran this ad. They then ran another series of radio ads with loud drums in the background sounding like maybe a rap song, said that Harold Ford is not one of us. He doesn't share our values. And then they would contrast that with a hybrid, almost national anthem and the University of Tennessee fight song, saying that my opponent, you know, represents the best of Tennessee. So they played on, a bunch of stereotypes. And all I could think was, you know, my plan, my response was to put both of my governors, my current Democratic governor, my former Democratic governor, in a TV ad to have them debunk some of this and rebut these things. And I couldn't, both of them had agreed to do it, and my former governor, when it came time to do the ad, for some reason he balked. He helped me in other ways, but he didn't want to do the ad. And it hurt me. I envisioned, you know, throughout the campaign how the Republicans would eventually inject race in an open and direct way, and I needed a very strong counter. And my counter was going to be this particular ad, but I never factored in that one of them would back out, or that the former governor would back out of doing the ad. So we just continued to work hard, and one of the great lessons I learned from that, and in the chapter in the book, I'm not bitter about it at all. I just talk fact, try to tell the truth about what happened and what I was thinking about and how it affected me. And that's your question. I mean, I thought it was brilliant. I stepped back from it. You always have to, I think, detach yourself from this stuff. If you take politics personally, you know, even if you win, you'll be a bitter person, and if you don't win, you'll be even more bitter. It certainly impacted me, and I certainly was upset about it and disappointed about how they conducted themselves, the Republicans. But having said that, you move on from it, and I learned a valuable lesson. I also speak in that chapter about how after the race, Bill Clinton called me that night and said, look, the way you behave in the morning and how you conduct yourself Wednesday morning after the election will determine more than anything your future in politics. You can be angry about it tonight, but don't be bitter about it tomorrow. And I've tried, and not only I follow that next day, but I've tried my hardest to follow that ever since.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? purchasing power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Research shows continuing your education is the best way to increase your earning potential. Grantham University can give you the education you've always wanted. With their exclusive partnership with AFGE, you'll receive discounted tuition available to AFGE members and their families. Grantham's degree programs are 100% online to fit your busy schedule. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with former Congressman Harold Ford Jr. and author of More Davids Than Goliaths, A Political Education. You were telling us just before the break about President Clinton and some advice he gave to you on short-term losses and long-term gains. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, I think they're lifelong lessons. It's something you can apply to any aspect of your life. After that Senate race, that particular night, I got a call from him as I was sharing, and he said, what you do tomorrow morning, how you behave, again, will determine whether or not, what kind of political future you have. You can't be bitter about these things. You have to remember that voters vote what they believe is best, and you move on. And if you are a true believer and you are honest about your participation in politics and honest about wanting to help make things better, you have to keep working towards that. So since the race, I now chair the Democratic Leadership Council. I did teach at Vanderbilt University in Nashville for 2 years, which I loved. And now that I live in New York, I teach at NYU. The passion I have for teaching did not wane after moving to New York, and fortunately an opportunity presented itself to be involved here in academic life. In addition, I'm a vice chairman at Bank of America, and I do some work for MSNBC and NBC News. So it's a nice mix. I spend an overwhelming majority of my time working in financial services, but the other pursuits allow for my public service appetite in a lot of ways to be met. There's nothing quite like being in an elected office. And the opportunity and ability to impact policymaking and impact people's lives directly like that. But I certainly have found great satisfaction in some of the work at the DLC and even the work on television.
Yeah, as I mentioned to you before we got started, even on the air, that I love watching you on MSNBC. I think you do a great job with that. And I'm fascinated about the DLC. I remember Jesse Jackson referring to it as Democrats for the leisure class. Do you think that the DLC is maybe going to get a little more progressive, or do you think they're still trying to pull the Democratic Party even further to the right?
No, I don't think that the DLC's, even the founding of it, its birth almost 25, 26 years ago now, has, the effort was never to pull it to the right. The effort has always been to help give voice to middle-class voters, and particularly middle-class Democrats. If you recall, when the DLC was birthed, it was after the 84 presidential race when Walter Mondale lost, who was a good man, but lost very badly to Ronald Reagan. And we had lost in 80 as well, and there was concern with some in the party that maybe we had become, as a Democratic Party, kind of a patchwork of different constituencies as opposed to a party with a coherent and cohesive voice. Now, Reverend Jackson, who's a friend, once the organization was founded in the late 80s and early 90s, was somewhat critical at times of it because some in the DLC didn't support lockstep all the Democratic ideas. That being said, the DLC, some of our biggest supporters, if not our biggest donors, are some in organized labor, or many in organized labor, I should say, and we're also fortunate to enjoy support from the private sector as well. But at its root, at our root, this organization's belief is very similar to what Bill Clinton believed, which is government has an enormous role to play in creating an atmosphere and a climate and a terrain for people to take risks, for jobs to be created, and for people who fall between the cracks to be taken care of. I don't think there's a president, and certainly the organization is only 26 years old, but the person who's most identifiable with the DLC has been Bill Clinton. There may be people who have issues with Bill Clinton's politics and policies, but you can't dispute the numbers. That more than 22 million jobs created when he was president, more kids matriculating into college in his 8 years as president, than any time outside of when the GI Bill was introduced. More people coming off welfare and finding jobs. The greatest period, greatest 8 years in the last 40 of environmental stewardship. Did he get everything done, President Clinton? Of course not. But this notion that the DLC somehow or another is against the middle class, when in fact middle class wages and wages for the lowest workers, lowest working class, their wages rose faster his 8 years than they had in 50 years prior. I think there's a lot to be said about the party finding its way back to the middle. And finally, I was 26 years old when I was elected to Congress. The budget had never been balanced. Matter of fact, the only president whom I've ever known to balance the budget has been a Democrat, was Bill Clinton. So I like that legacy. You know, Bill Clinton had didn't do everything right, but I think it's hard, be hard pressed to find any American right now who wouldn't dream of the great legacy of Bill Clinton creating jobs and balancing the budget. That seems to be the fire behind the Tea Party right now, at least what's coloring and fueling there. Their energy, and frankly, I think a majority of Democrats would love a day to return when millions of jobs are being created each year and when the budget is balanced. So I don't run from the DLC at all. I'm proud of the legacy and hopeful that, not that we can pull the party to the right, but that we can pull politics as a whole, the whole body politic, back to a place where we're growing again and we're balancing our budget.
Let's also talk a little about, you mentioned in your book, your trip to the visit the troops in Afghanistan, Iraq, and you had some stories about that. Can you share that with us?
Sure. One of my last trip to Afghanistan and Iraq actually was January of 2006. I traveled with Senator Evan Bayh, who would go each year. He may go twice a year, but I know he would go every year at the beginning of the year, and he was kind enough to let me tag along as a member of Congress. Congressmen and senators didn't always go on trips together, but Bayh was very kind to have me on his trips. Barack Obama, then Senator Obama, was on that trip. I'll never forget one night we were in Iraq. We had dinner at the then president's home of Iraq, and we were joined that evening by Shalabi, who many people blame for, you know, presenting the evidence to America that showed that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. You may recall he lived in London. He was part of a group of Iraqis that had defected the country, had been run out of the country in many ways. And he was there that evening. He was somewhat of a controversial figure, but he was there at dinner. It was a very happy family-like dinner with Evan Bayh, Kit Bond, Senator Obama, and myself as their guests, and Maria Cantwell. Maria Cantwell was not on that trip, but the four of us were on that trip. And I'll never forget, we sat around the table. Shalabi made this, I write about this in the book, his suggestion to us at that point about what he thought could help change the dynamic in Iraq and make the country safer and more prosperous was for America to help fund a version of Fannie Mae in Iraq. And I say in the book that Shalabi believed that home ownership for Iraqis was the long-term answer to their challenges and problems. And I never forget sitting across from then-Senator Obama. He was literally about right across from me, a person to my right. And we looked at each other and really tried not to smile too much. I mean, it was hard to take Shalabi that seriously, I mean, but in light of his reputation. But I was just surprised, almost shocked at how he had no shame. He was, you know, many people believe he had taken millions of dollars from the American government in exchange for, you know, bad intelligence, which it, the evidence proved that. Yet here he was now promoting another idea that would line his pockets in a lot of ways. And the idea he had for the person to run this organization was himself. It was fascinating to me. I traveled to Iraq and Afghanistan probably four or five times while I was in Congress. And as I shared in the book, it was all enough to thank the troops. But it gave me a much better understanding of what was happening on the ground, why it was happening, and the kinds of things that we, that our military should be thinking about. And more importantly, that we as lawmakers in Congress, how we should be approaching the issue. I didn't always agree with my own party on some of their ideas. I certainly didn't agree with Bush and his approach. I thought he waited far too long to undertake a larger presence of American troops in Iraq, which ultimately helped, you know, and even some the tactics that were used by then Petraeus with the uprising with funding some in Iraq who had every reason to be supportive of us, the Sunni uprising, as we remember. So it was a great thing, and I hope that every member of Congress and the Senate, even if this effort in Iraq winds down, America continues to try to understand what its footprint will be there, that members of Congress and the Senate travel there more often, just to not only hear the troops but to hear the commanders and to see for themselves how our money is being spent, how U.S. tax dollars are being spent, and how they can better be spent. And, of course, I talked about attending funerals for these really young men and women who gave their lives on our behalf. And you just gain a much better understanding of what generals mean when they say, when the best generals often say, look, war is the last option. And the generals would say how much they hated war. You gain a firsthand understanding while you're on the ground in Iraq, but you gain an even deeper understanding when you attend the funeral of a 24-year-old or 23-year-old or 26-year-old whose life is just very much at the beginning.
And as we go into our last minute, there was a very moving story you had in the book about having dinner in Afghanistan with a Tennessee soldier who was struggling to take care of his family back home. Can you detail that for us a little bit?
Sure. It was a young man. I'm glad that part of it was very touching. This young man worked for a company that develops sports products, golf products. And he was complaining about how he was probably going to lose his job. And his wife, you know, worked, but his income was really he was the key breadwinner in the house. And he said, look, you know, I want to be here serving my country. He was a what we call a weekend warrior. He was in the National Guard, but he was serving time in Iraq or doing time in Iraq, you know, equal to what active duty members were doing, full-time members were doing. And I got back after that trip, and I said, you know, it's unbelievable that we don't pay these guys enough. But if they have jobs and they're leaving their jobs, we ought to be providing 100% tax credits to their employers to continue paying them for at least up to 12 months while they're gone, since their terms or their duty time has been extended. That was one of the, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's one of the great examples of ideas, and some of that eventually passed. We didn't do it for 12 months, but Congress eventually passed, you know, some credits for business people to continue paying people who work for them who were members of the National Guard. Those type of visits and those type of experiences made me a much better, a much more complete lawmaker. And again, I can only hope that my former colleagues and even people in Congress who I didn't serve with, that they will take advantage of you know, trying to understand better what happens in live theaters and how better you can help returning men and women who the thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, will be returning, who will need every help from housing assistance to job assistance, obviously to mental health services as well.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government. But listen to our members, the real people who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me, I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by John Wilson, the Executive Director of the National Education Association. Welcome to Inside Government.
Thank you, Ward. Good to be with you.
So this week, the NEA hosted the National Summit on Family, School, and Community Engagement. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, NEA believes very strongly that if we're going to create great public schools for every student, making sure that parents or any family members and community are engaged in the education process. We know when we have a very strong parent-families community engagement, kids learn better.
And who attended this program?
Well, it was actually, we had about 20 partners that went from the National PTA to the National Indian Child Welfare Association, National League of Cities, National Urban League. So we had about 200 participants from these 20 partner organizations, as well as we invited leaders of our own affiliates at NEA and leaders of state departments of public instruction within many of our states around the nation. So it was 200 participants, and they were strong advocates for parent-family community engagement.
And The need for more engagement from the community obviously makes it better for the students, makes it a better learning environment overall. But does it also help in terms of working with Congress on the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act?
Yes, I think when parents, family, community are engaged in schools, they start to learn what the priorities are, and particularly at the school level. You know, so often policymakers get involved at this 30,000 foot and think, oh, if we would only do this policy, you know, it would change the world. So the voice of those who are on the ground and working with schools, you know, provide a very credible voice for what it really takes to educate a child, particularly a child who may not have all the circumstances that middle class or upper income students might have.
And I know some of the listeners to this show know I used to be the general counsel for the American Federation of Teachers in Maryland before I got to AFGE. And one of the things teachers used to always talk about at these kinds of conferences were things like access to a working Xerox machine. I mean, I don't know if people in the community really know what teachers have to put up with in terms of, you know, the situation. Do you think as people come into the schools and interact with teachers and learn those things, support for funding for education improves and the learning of children improve?
Yes, I think that any time you get third-party validators for what teachers and support professionals are saying, you are advantaged in making your case to policymakers. I also think that in these days of economic woe, you know, parents are being asked to provide a lot more support, you know, for the schools. And I'm sure they're, like, stunned, you know, when teachers are sending home lists and it not only includes, you know, number two pencils, but it also includes toilet paper, and they wonder, what's that about? And so I think when they're in the school and they see, you know, that schools are not being adequately funded, that oftentimes instructional materials and the facilities, you know, are the first to be cut, and no one wants their child to be in a situation that is not safe and that is not healthy. And I think that when you can unite parents and teachers with that voice to advocate for children, it's a very powerful voice.
And I think it's very interesting to talk about what goes on outside of the classroom. I mean, people always want to focus on, you know, testing the children, testing the teachers, test, test, test. That seems to be the mantra over the past decade. But really, a lot of learning goes on outside of the classroom and outside of the school, or doesn't go on out there. And that has a large effect on what happens. Are you finding that as that's getting addressed, that maybe there's some creative ideas for how to handle that?
Right. We know in the 21st century, a child's learning is not only inside the school, but outside the school. You know, with access to technology, they're 24/7 learners. And I think that to make that very useful and, quite frankly, aligned with what we're doing in the more formal education, that parents engaged in that process is very helpful, so that they're able to monitor the students around technology needs. That they're able to complement in after-school learning programs what schools are doing. NEA has been working with the Boys Clubs and Girls Clubs of America, and one of the things that we're finding, they do great work, but there's no communication with the schools. And so we're trying to create this connection by increasing our retired members who volunteer at the Boys Club or Girls Club, and to kind of be the connector between the after school program and the school. And so I think that the more parents and teachers are talking to each other, the more they can maximize a child's learning.
And that sounds like a huge disconnect that maybe has been there in the past, that if we bring that together, particularly in communities where maybe you have underperforming schools, but you also have socioeconomic issues that are going on, you might have parents that, you know, are having issues as well, and having something outside the classroom to connect, that sounds like a perfect fix to link everything together.
Absolutely. 'Cause the one thing we know, that all parents love their children. And I think if you start with that premise, then it's finding ways that are comfortable, that are inviting for parents to make those connections at schools. One of the things that NEA did for the schools in Seattle, we funded a project up to $1 million to increase parent engagement. And in the old days, you know, teachers used to visit the homes of parents before kids even came to school. And we kind of got away from that, and then it became a safety issue or a language issue. And so we decided that we need to really bond teachers and parents very early in that school year. And so I'll admit that teachers were a little weary of this. But when we created this program that gave them the support with translators, or with people who lived in the community to introduce them to the parents, and our teachers went into the homes and into the community, the dividend that we received on that was unreal, because all of a sudden, when teachers connected to parents on their turf, there was so much more comfort of coming to the school and making sure that that they knew what was happening in the school with their child. And so working hand in hand became a very powerful measure, and quite frankly, the student learning went up considerably in these schools. And so we're very pleased with that kind of project, and we continue to really want to make sure that every school has a parent engagement program.
And, you know, with all these good ideas, the thing that kind of looms out there with the real estate bubble bursting and that being where a lot of property taxes go to fund education at the local level, so there's a funding crisis in most states, and I guess in California, I mean, people saw layoffs and things like that. Are you worried that we're not going to have the kind of funding we need for education, and what do you think we need to do about that?
Well, there is no doubt that schools are suffering. We continue to get reports that we have not brought back all the teachers that were laid off, even though the federal government gave $10 billion to do that. Particularly in California, it wasn't enough for California. And some are so anxious about next year that they're trying to save the money. And so we're finding lots of class sizes are going up. We're finding we're losing art and music and dance and those arts programs that a lot of kids would never get if they don't get them through the public schools. Obviously, instructional materials monies are being cut. And it's a situation that is about to go into a crisis mode in many school systems. And so we believe that engaging the community, making sure that they know what the needs are, and they know, you know, what the results are if you don't have the funding, is pretty vital. And the last thing I'll say about that is that we have a very strange tax system in this country. And when a Warren Buffett pays a lower tax rate than his secretary, you know, something's wrong. And so I think that we have an obligation for parents and the community to understand how schools are funded and how that structure is very flawed for today's time, and that we really need to review some of these systems that we've had in place for decades, and that schools are going to have to be funded a different way.
And, you know, unfortunately, this seems like a horrible time to try to address this, because when you think about the people that are showing up at the tea parties, you know, where they feel like they're taxed enough already, and yet we're in a funding crisis where we're going to be, you know, maybe losing teachers, increasing class size. And we do need to have that discussion that you can't simply cut your way out of a budget deficit. I mean, at some point you have to look at revenue streams. Are you finding any creative ideas out on the horizon? I mean, I know the Bush tax cuts, maybe if, you know, we raise taxes on dead rich people that, you know, make them pay their fair share, that might work. But it seems like you're going to need more money than that. And where's it going to come from?
Well, we know absolutely there's a lot of tax loopholes. And that if we can close those loopholes, that will go a long way to making sure that there's adequate funding. We also know that we haven't really taxed services. And so people feel like, you know, their property taxes are, you know, at about the level that they're willing to accept, or even they're very unhappy about property taxes. But at the same time, there are other things that we've never taxed. You know, getting a haircut, and some of the states are moving towards that. And I think that as our economy has changed, we're going to have to change how we generate taxes, because, you know, that's what makes government services work. And if we really want to have government services that provide and fulfill the expectation of our citizenry, you know, then we're going to have a tax structure that makes that work. And you can't have quality government services, including public schools, if you don't have a quality funding system.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Research shows continuing your education is the best way to increase your earning potential. Grantham University can give you the education you've always wanted. With their exclusive partnership with AFGE, you'll receive discounted tuition available to AFGE members and their families. Grantham's degree programs are 100% online to fit your busy schedule. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Have you been to AFGE's new online store? Members and activists can now purchase AFGE items online using a credit card and have them conveniently shipped right to your door. Visit the store at www.afgestore.org. You'll be able to buy all the hottest AFGE products, from hats and watches to coffee mugs and pens, plus the famous Inside Government t-shirts. That's more than 70 items to choose from. Start shopping today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by one of our favorite guests, former Representative Bob Edgar of Pennsylvania and the President and CEO of Common Cause. Welcome back to Inside Government.
It's great to be with you today.
Now, 2010 marks the 40th anniversary of Common Cause, which you're celebrating in October with a two-day conference. Is that right?
That's correct. On August 18th, 1970, John Gardner, who was quite a Renaissance man, created Common Cause, and we're celebrating the legacy of John Gardner and Archibald Cox, who was fired by Richard Nixon and some others, Democrats and Republicans, who are trying to hold government accountable. And on the 5th, 6th of October, we have a lot of things planned, including a major democracy conference that will start at noon on the 5th and go in Washington through about 5 o'clock on the 6th. And the highlight of that conference is a couple things. One is a suspected Hill visit and also a White House visit, perhaps with face-to-face with the Vice President. But also Arianna Huffington is going to open the conference on Tuesday with a plenary. She has a new book coming out, and she'll be talking with everyone about her take on the shape of our society, given the Tea Party and other things. By the way, at the end of the conference, we have a 40th anniversary dinner, and we've got an amazing array of people. Bill Moyers is going to be a host. Sam Waterston from Law and Order is going to be there. And also, one new wrinkle for us is that our new chair of the board of Common Cause is someone that many people know and respect, and that's Robert Reich, former labor secretary, who will come on board as our chair of the board, my boss, and help us lift Common Cause to scale.
Now, Common Cause has always had a very long and passionate history for being nonpartisan or perhaps bipartisan sometimes. Give a little more history, I guess, to folks who don't know why and how Common Cause got founded.
Common Cause got founded back in the very late 60s, early 70s, mostly by leaders who were moderate Republicans. John Gardner was a moderate Republican, and two or three of our other founders came out of the Rockefeller, Eisenhower, Lincoln branch of the Republican Party. And in the early 70s, they believed that everyone had lobbyists in Washington, but average, ordinary people. So they wanted a people's lobby, and Common Cause got started. And back in the 70s, I think many of us joined organizations, became members of groups like the Sierra Club and Bread for the World, Common Cause. We thought that if we joined organizations, we could fix the problems that we faced. The only difference today is that I think people are joining organizations less, and it's probably more accurate to say people are joining movements today. When Al Gore did his movie on global warming, people didn't run out and join an environmental group. They joined the global warming movement. And what we're trying to do is recalibrate Common Cause for this decade by helping it to become part of the engine of the good government movement, and using social media, using other gifts and skills that have been put in place over the last 40 years to maybe do some more work in collaboration. Common Cause has a great reputation, It has faded a little bit over the last few years, mainly because of financial exigencies and problems. But we have an ability to convene organizations to work on trying to get money out of politics, work on ethics and lobbying reform. And we're about to do something that's a bit controversial. We're about to sue the United States Senate on the issue of the filibuster. We believe that the filibuster is unconstitutional. We'd like Democrats, Republicans, and independents across the country to really raise a national conversation about whether or not we want majority rule or whether we want the tyranny of the minority.
Now, that's a very interesting one. I haven't heard a lot about that. So tell us some more. Who else is supporting you on that at this point?
Well, inside the United States Senate, Senator Tom Harkin is one of our heroes because even when the Democrats were in the minority, he believed that there should be a modification of the filibuster rule, and he has a proposal that would keep the 60 votes needed, but 2 weeks after the cloture vote, it would go down to 57 votes, then to 55 votes, and within a 6 or 7 week period, go down to a majority vote so that 40 people could not hold the institution hostage. There are some other senators like Senator Barbara Mikulski, Senator Tom Udall, and others who believe that the filibuster has simply stopped the legislative process, and they're working with us to use the issue over October, November, December to have this national conversation, to try in January on a parliamentary action to change the rule, and if that fails, to continue with the lawsuit. It's a very complicated and difficult and uphill battle. The United States Senate is broken, and we hope that our effort of bringing some national spotlight on the filibuster we'll get people's attention. Here's an interesting statistic for you. There are more than 400 pieces of legislation that have passed the House of Representatives. Many of those pieces of legislation have passed by large majorities, 80-90% of the Democrats and Republicans supporting them, and they're now stuck in the Senate because of the silly Senate rules where one senator can hold up appointments and the leadership on the minority side can simply find 40 people to block all consideration of things like health care and public education and quality of life issues that are so important.
Now, as a former member of Congress, I mean, you've been there, you've sat in those chairs, you know, maybe not in the Senate, but, you know, for those of us that haven't, I mean, we're used to seeing Mr. Smith goes to Washington, Billy Jack goes to Washington, where they're, you know, they're at 2 a.m. and they're debating all through the night and all through the weekend. But that's really not happening. It's just the threat of the filibuster right. seems to be causing this. Do you think maybe minimally they ought to say, okay, you know, call them on that. If you're going to filibuster, then let's see one. Let's see if people will really put up with that.
Before I answer your question, which I want to answer, let me ask you a question. How many filibusters do you think there were in 1939 when Mr. Smith Goes to Washington won an Academy Award?
I'm going to say one.
There were zero. There were absolutely no filibusters in 1939. And in fact, in a two-year congressional cycle, there were less than four or five filibusters over the last, 75 years, up until about 1990. This year, there are over 140 filibusters, and that doesn't even count the threat of filibuster. The Democrats in leadership are so fearful if they don't have a hard lock on 60 votes, they simply pull the bill. So it is important to draw attention to this. We need some courageous leadership on the part of the Senate, and you are right. We need to go back to the original rules. If they're going to keep the filibuster, then the folks have to stay on the floor and keep debating. The problem is that the majority has to stay on the floor, because if it goes below a quorum, then the filibuster folks win. And I think the Democrats made a mistake in going along with changing the rules so that they simply pull the bills if they lose a cloture vote or if they have a threat of a cloture vote. I think they ought to go back, spotlight the issue, show which members of the Senate are holding up consideration of important legislation. And they've just not been willing to do it. And one other issue that Common Cause is really active on, and that is trying to limit money in politics. fight things like the Citizens United case. One of the reasons some of the Democrats don't want to take a hard line on forcing the filibuster to actually be a filibuster is that they use that time to go back and raise money. And both the Democrats and Republicans spend too much time, 40, 50, 60% of their time, raising money for their reelection, and they don't want to simply be sitting on the House or sitting on the Senate floor waiting for the opposition minority to run out of vocal gas.
And let's talk about campaign finance reform. I mean, that's been a hot-button issue now for quite some time, and obviously the Citizens United case has changed the landscape to some extent. But I know with a lot of folks that when they look at Citizens United and you think that corporations can spend this unlimited amount of money, one of the things people have talked about is because a lot of people with their 401k plans, they have money invested in these corporations. They want to know, why are my profits that should be coming to my retirement going to fund not just political campaigns, but lobbyists as well for insurance companies and everybody else instead of my retirement profits? Is anybody looking to kind of regulate that?
Well, we should be really, really concerned. The Citizens United case is an awful precedent suggesting that corporations are people. My wife, who's a registered nurse, says that she'll believe corporations are people the day after they have a colonoscopy. It also came down and said that the founding fathers thought that money was speech. Many of us believe money can stifle speech. We did a study at Common Cause on both health care and the oil companies. And if you go on our website, you'll find legislating under the influence on health care and legislating under the influence on oil. And you'll see how much money the oil companies and the medical industry put in to shaping the debate. Many people in the labor community were hopeful that single payer and public option would get a serious hearing during the health care debate. That was already predetermined when the health care industry spent over $3 billion hiring lobbyists just from 2000 to 2008, and an additional $350 million into the pockets of Democrats and Republicans who serve on the committees of jurisdiction. So while the public was watching Fox News and CNN and MSNBC and watching the debate, much of that debate was tainted because of the amount of money. And if you go and look at the oil spill and see how much money the oil companies have put in to weakening and lessening regulations and fines, you'll discover that corporations are, in fact, dictating the outcome of our policies because of the current flood of money in politics.
And obviously that's not been very transparent because people, would want to know that that's money that should be in their retirement accounts but got diverted by companies. But as we talk about transparency, let's talk about some government transparency. I know with the Obama administration, that was a real goal. And as we come into our last minute, what's Common Cause's take on how transparent government's become in the last year?
Well, I think they've made some efforts. My complaint with the Obama administration is they blasted lobbyists, but they haven't connected lobbyists with money, and there's a toxic cocktail between the two. They've done a little better job of showing who shows up at the White House. That's helpful. But I think those of us who care about good government and policy want as much full transparency as possible. I invite your listeners to sign up and go to our website, take a look at the conference. And not only is Arianna Huffington there, but we believe that Washington is broken, and we hope that our 2 days of conversation will help to give some guidance on how to fix the problems we face, whether it's money, whether it's election protection, whether it's ethics, whether it's lobbying reform, or whether it's trying to deal with issues like the filibuster and others. They'll all be fully discussed at our conference, and we need everybody to participate. We want this to be the people's conference, not just something that Common Cause is putting on.
Thank you to our guests this week, former Congressman Harold Ford Jr. and Bob Edgar, and National Education Association Executive Director John Wilson. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and Grantham University.